This is XTP Media.
Welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Welcome back to Aviation Extended. Hi, I'm Peter Johnson. Today's episode features a topic we've not covered before, aviation archaeology. Jonathan Johnny McNee, BEN, is an aviation historian and military aviation archaeologist whose voluntary work has literally brought lost aircraft and their stories back into the light. He was awarded the British Empire Medal earlier this year in the King's Honour List for his services to military aviation archaeology. It recognised years of unpaid work recovering wartime crash sites and telling the stories behind them. Johnny's best known for his work on Second World War crash sites across Northern Ireland and along the Irish border. He's led or helped lead excavation on RAF Spitfires, including the well-known Donegal and Monaghan Spitfires, a US P-38 Lightning that came down in the border region, and a Bristol Beaufort near Ballykelly. In each case, the focus has not just been on recovering pieces of the aircraft, but on rebuilding the human story. Who flew the aircraft? What had happened on the day of the crash? And how that event touched families and local communities? A big part of Johnny's work is collaboration. He works closely with local museums, as well as schools and community groups. The wreckages his teams recover have gone on to feature in museum displays, education projects and public commemorations, including memorials and even flypasts that honour the crews involved. In this conversation, we'll explore how Johnny found his way into aviation archaeology and what it takes to locate and excavate a crash site, how he navigates the ethical side of digging into often tragic events. And we'll hear some of the stories he's helped to unearth with the communities who are still living with the memories of those crashes today. Johnny, welcome to Extended.
Good evening. Glad to be with you.
It's a real pleasure to have you. I'm delighted to have you on board for this feature. It's a topic I'm really unfamiliar with, and I think most people are. But before we talk about aviation archaeology, let's have a little dig into how you got interested in aviation. And although the listeners can't see it, I'm looking at you in a room with lots of great models and photos of aircraft. So in there is a real aviation geek. Where did that come from?
I honestly don't know, and haven't been asked the question several times. I sort of been speaking to like my mum and dad, and they just said, you know, as a child, 3 or 4, we would have bought you, or Santa would have brought you at Christmas, you know, an Airfix kit. And you can imagine, you know, a 3 or 4 year old on the kitchen table gluing himself to the table and then spilling the enamel paint everywhere. I just apparently was never happy. They would set me up on Christmas Day and I wouldn't be seen to like Boxing Day or the day after. Making really bad Spitfires and Hurricanes and Lancasters and Mosquitoes. And it sort of, I never, you know, grew out of that. There was always that inner feeling that this is something interesting. And then my father announced one day that he was going to become a minister. He was leaving his very well-paid job as a company director in Northern Ireland and said, from now on, we're going to have no money and I'm training to join the church.
Wow.
And then, you know, we all sat there laughing, waiting for the punchline, but it never came. He actually did go to Dublin, became a minister, right? And had a very successful career, you know, fairly, you know, later on in his business life in the church. But I think that's where I started to notice, you know, particularly in the country parishes where he was at and some of the other, you know, city parishes, those old groups of guys that wouldn't say much but sat down the back of the church.
Yeah.
And then come Remembrance Sunday, suddenly were bedecked in medals.
Yeah.
And you would learn about the medals and you would say, could I just ask what these are for? And then you got to hear the stories. And then, well, come down to the house, I'll show you all the things that, you know, I've kept from my days. And these were things that, you know, nobody in the parish knew about. So I was always trying to, you know, promote the history of these guys and getting it out there, because sadly you only find out that old Jimmy flew Spitfires in the Battle of Britain at his funeral, which is not the time to learn, you know. Yeah. So that was that. And then I moved to the northwest part of Northern Ireland, where we have all those, you know, coastal airfields that were so important during the war. You could actually meet people that had, you know, built the runways. You could meet people that had served and helped the crew with their ironing and laundry and getting them food. You could still then trace some of the pilots, and you could see, particularly like after the war, you know, with the burgeoning motorway system in England across the water, you know, a lot of the airfields were grubbed up and turned into aggregate to feed the roads. Well,
yeah.
Whereas we in Northern Ireland, we sort of started throwing, you know, rocks and boulders and worse at each other over here. So we never really got into that. We spent all our money on, you know, fortifying our towns from each other. And as a result, all these old airfields just like became engrossed in nettles and brambles. So if you asked nicely, you could still get access to these very well-preserved features, runways still there, and just listen for the ghosts of the past and then try and dig out the stories.
Yeah, wow. Wow, that sounds fascinating. And there's a colleague, in fact, actually, I've got to give a bit of a shout out to a colleague called Dave Homewood. He runs a podcast called the Wings Over New Zealand podcast, and he's a fascinating character, and he's the one who said, you've got to go and speak to Johnny McNee, you've got to go and speak to him. And I was like, why? He said, it's fascinating what these guys are doing. And he does a similar thing. He's actually in the UK now, wandering around old airfields and going looking at the memorials and that sort of thing. But it's just getting so much harder to do these days. But anyway, let's move on. Let's talk about how do you describe aviation archaeology? How would you describe what you do?
Well, it depends who you ask. If you ask my family, they would say it is the regular messing up of the garage and making everything smell of aviation fuel. And I think, you know, the proper qualified archaeologists who have a lot of time for, when I ask them to do any of these projects, would describe it as that sort of like an annoying area that they know there's legislation for, but they've never been involved in, so they don't use it and they know next to nothing about it, but they do know that it's important.
Yeah.
But with a straight bat, it is the, when required, because certainly in Northern Ireland, the usual line is it's preservation in situ. So unless you need to dig an aircraft up for like an important reason, like it's in the way of a development, or there may be, you know, sometimes there's ordnance issues or some other issues, or it's going to a properly curated professional museum, it is the licensed research, and then all the applications to get the licenses, both from in Northern Ireland, where we run a tandem approach where you need your archaeological license, as well as your MOD license under the Protection of Military Remains, which is unique in the UK and works excellently. And I know that the MOD are trying to see, can they introduce a similar thing? Because at the minute, across the water, the MOD license is like one or two pages. And then you're given your license, which lasts you for a year. But there's no archaeological intent. And a lot of people are doing it correctly. There are other possibly nefarious characters that are after the parts selling and all that sort of stuff. And I don't want to go there. Whereas over here, we then also have to apply for a license that says, well, what's your archaeological experience? How are you going to dig it up? Why are you going to dig it up? Where are you going to put it? How are you going to preserve it? What's your preservation skills? So it means at the end of the day, there's a complete package, and the MOD won't issue a license until our authorities do it. So it works hand in hand that they know the aircraft is going to be lifted within the law, but also archaeologically done. So you can get the best amount of information out of it as to how did it enter the ground? Did it match up to what the eyewitnesses say? You know, how was it preserved? All that sort of stuff. So that's it. And as a non-qualified archaeological person, but I've been doing this for about 25 odd years, it's a very niche it's like a sub-discipline of proper archaeology. There's no courses or no training, and nine times out of ten, John, you're training the archaeologists that come with us, you know, on the forensic analysis of the aircraft. But they are wonderful supporters of it here in Northern Ireland, because they can see the benefits, A, from learning themselves, and then B, particularly the schools, getting young people in. Because when we do digs, we can have 25, you know, pupils, and you can't get them out of the hole at the end of the day. Whereas if they say we're going to excavate a moat at a castle, the archaeologists can't get anybody to come out.
So two questions jump out of that. I just want to go back and ask. And the first one was, when we started talking over email, you did give me some pretty, looked like some complicated legal stuff. How complex is that to navigate?
There are a lot of it's I think when the aviation archaeology started, you know, it was possibly, you know, just after the Battle of Britain, and then all the after the war, and the films all came out, and people got quite interested, you know, in that history, and people essentially rampaged around, you know, from county to county, digging up aircraft. And there's a lot of, you know, this is my turf, you can't come and look for planes in my turf. And it wasn't done with any great archaeological understanding. It was, we've got an engine, it goes into a museum, or it goes into somebody's garage and nobody gets to see it. Over here with us, yes, there's the two main sets of logistics. Is your MOD license, which basically will say, are there any human remains? If not, go away, it's not happening. Are there any bombs, you know, ordnance, have anything, you know, big of that nature? Again, it's not happening. If you cannot satisfy the archaeological requirements over here, the MOD will say, I'm sorry, we just can't entertain this at all.
Okay.
And that will involve, like, how are you going to pay for this? Because it's not a matter of just running out, getting a JCB and digging. I mean, some of the ones that we do, they are major excavations, miles from the nearest road. You're digging 40-foot deep holes. That all requires tremendous health and safety, all your insurance, and then all your ordnance stuff as well. You know, I know the MOD licenses say, well, you may come across some bullets, but over here, the Northern Ireland office is saying, right, well, you suddenly just can't possess 20 millimeter bullets or a Browning machine gun. You know, you need to license all that.
Right.
And then there's all the asbestos and anything that glows in the dark, and all the, you know, the various paints and things that were put over these aircraft, compressed air bottles, explosive incendiaries to set off the aircraft when you crash an enemy line. So there's a lot of things that will blow you up if you look at them the wrong way, that there aren't ordnance. You have to deal with all of that, especially if you're working with other people and or you're trying to involve the local community and schools.
Wow. Okay. That's a deep one. So the other question that sprung to mind when you were talking there, and this is purely my naivety about the whole topic, is how or when do you come across something that you feel you need to investigate? You know, is there a map of hundreds of sites? Is that, does it, do they come up by accident, or is there, I'm just trying to understand a bit of scale, I suppose.
Sometimes you think it's fate that you step off one and you promise your wife, I'm never going to do this again. And then someone will just say, so-and-so was just talking about a plane. We'll go and have a wee look. And then there's something in it. You know, you go and look at various sites, and you go, that's very interesting. Yes, you know, but now we know where exactly where it is. But there's others that just get you, John, and you just think.
Yeah.
Like when we did in Monaghan, we arrived out at the site. We didn't mean to go there. We were doing something else with the council in Northern Ireland. And I said, when we're down this far, there was a Battle of Britain, you know, vintage aircraft that crashed somewhere down over the border, and the pilot landed on one side and the plane flew over. Well, we'll just go down and we'll have a wee nosy and see what happens. We found it within 5 minutes, and then we went to knock on the landowner's house, And it was a wonderful lady called Josie, who then sat us down and over the biggest rhubarb pie I've ever seen in my life and endless cups of tea, talked about how she had seen this aircraft crash in front of her aged five.
Wow.
In 1942. And she says, there are days when I can't remember my name, but I can tell you what I was wearing. I can tell you the ribbons and my hair, my shoes and my dress the day that that aircraft crashed 100 metres in front of me. And we just thought, that's a story. That lady's still alive and wants to know what happened to that plane. And we actually, you know, she came out on dig day, met the pilot's relatives, and then the museum, Monaghan County Museum, got that excited when we got it all up, that they said, well, we'll put on a little exhibition, which went on to win this big Irish award.
Wow.
And then we had to do all the other aircraft. So they all sort of, you know, step off in Monaghan, and then something else happens and you just go, yeah, that's the next one.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
I don't know. There's something just putting planes in front of our noses and we go, yeah, we need to do that one. And they're all great wee stories in themselves.
Wow. Okay. So for someone who's never been, well, for most people, who've never been near and do you call it a dig? Do you call it a site or?
It can be called a lot of things, but yes, dig site, you know, but they just become, they're just projects until you think, do we need to go and lift? Is there a reason? Knowing that we've found it, that's enough. You walk away. But unless, if it's for like a museum exhibition or some of the other more sensitive ones that we've done, we just call them sites.
Yeah. So how does a site sort of unfold? How do you mark it out? How do you know where to dig it? What sort of equipment do you need to use? How does it, so what's the process, I suppose? Because you're not doing it with paintbrushes, are you? Most of it.
No. And on previous digs, when we had archaeologists with us, we did actually put a little trowel and a paintbrush and we taped them onto the end of the digger bucket and let the digger bucket just scrape. And that went down like a lead balloon. No, what we would do is there's a lot of knocking on doors until you actually find out, because the RAF records sometimes are very bland and it will say, like, you know, crashed in a field near a school, something like that. And then you go out to that area and you knock on a lot of doors to try to find the right field. And then again, with the archaeological laws, particularly around metal detecting and using ground penetrating radar, we always go straight back to the head of licensing in Historic Environment Division. And we'll say, look, we're out looking at we site. Again, promises, no digging, but we just will be detecting. And we let them know as a courtesy. And you'll go out and you will use a metal detector to detect, are we getting any sort of debris pattern? And you will dig up the horseshoes and all the usual detritus from agricultural life. But sometimes then you will get a scatter. And so we'll mark that all with flags. Then we will run the ground penetrating radar over it. And I work with a wonderful guy, Dr. Alistair Ruffell from Queen's University, who's one of the most foremost experts in this dark art. And he can look deep down into the earth with his kit. And then you can, all of a sudden, you can see a crater. And you can see all the reflective patterns coming back, and ground penetrating radar is progressing in leaps and bounds from what we started off.
Yeah.
It practically does it itself now. It's great. You can sit in a car and remote control it. So you will know that everything's there, and then you can start to analyze, well, what do the eyewitnesses say? Does the vegetation, we can throw up a drone with a vegetation package on it, and it will say, for example, the soil in this area is contaminated, the vegetation isn't growing as well, or particularly if there's been a big disturbance of the ground, then it all resettles. You might get nettles growing and nothing else. So there's a lot of things that clue you into the site. Very little. We also would detect around the field because of the farmers ploughing it. You then go and look where they'll pick up a bit, throw it into the hedge line. So that's always a good place. And then you decide, do we need to do anything, or do we just then go back to the archaeologists and say, just so you know, if anything ever happens in this field, at that coordinate there, you have an aircraft. You know, it's just an empty aircraft. You know, the pilot bailed out and they're safe and there's, you know, no bombs or bullets. And we just make sure that then that there's a proper mark on the historic register records so that people know there's something there.
Right. Wow. God, a million questions. How does that differentiate. No, let me come back a bit further. Are we predominantly talking about World War II here?
Yes, it would be almost exclusively World War II. Say up in our part of the world, you had, you know, four or five coastal airfields. You have young men learning to fly, flying fast aircraft, flying next to hills where they built Annaloo, RAF Limavady. They put that next to a cliff face, thought that was a good idea. And then with the changing weather that we have, you have just everything. It's a perfect recipe for crashes, and particularly, you know, the bombers, the Whitleys and Wellingtons and Liberators, you know, when they crashed, you know, that's 8-9 people. Yeah. And I go. So we have almost, working with the guys at the Ulster Aviation Society, we have something like 1,100 wartime crash, you know, incidents. That could be from you landing and, you know, scraping your wingtips along the runway to you crashing and totaling your aircraft.
Yeah.
And, you know, several thousand fatalities. And that's on land. And then there's that many that took off that nobody knows where they went, you know, into the Atlantic as well.
And again, really naive question, I'm afraid, Johnny. We're talking about aircraft that are buried, in effect, covered. I'm trying to get my head around the history of how those sorts of things happen. I'm a London boy. I'm of an age where I still remember London being very derelict because of the bomb sites and things like that. So I sort of have a feeling for why things went on. But I'm trying to get my head around why were so many of these sites, particularly in Northern Ireland, why have they been covered? You know, an aircraft hits the ground, there would have been either a crater or a debris or whatever. Is there any sort of anecdotal evidence or commentary on why there are still so many buried in the ground?
It's very much to do with terrain. And then as we teach the pupils in the schools that are very interested in this, particularly the pupils in Foyle College and Derry, where your wonderfulness, it's also to do with geology and the time of year that they crash. We have found from our excavations that if the site is easily accessible, then the RAF or the Fleet Air Arm crash teams were absolutely wonderful in their post-crash tidy up. So we did one that crashed. It was actually a Coastal Command Beaufort that crashed in the front garden of a Church of Ireland directory in Ballykelly. And you can see where the aircraft sort of belly flopped in from about 300 feet. Sadly, the crew of three were killed. And we got a special license just to make sure that the site was effectively clear of all human remains. And you can see how they levelled up the site using, you know, sort of second-hand red bricks that they'd brought in to level it, thinking it's the front garden of the rectory, we can't leave it like a mess. And then also you can see what the crash teams were having for their dinner, the porcelain, the bottles, the beer bottles, the lemonade bottles. They go into the hole last. So you get that. But other ones that go into the sea, you know, in for example, Loch Foyle, there's no scrap value. Nobody can get out to get those, so those stay. The ones that crash high up in the mountains of Donegal, again, immediately after the clearance, the community that would go, there's all that metal up there, all that wiring, and there would be like fights amongst the scrap men, and we have seen them, you know, bringing the engines off flying fortresses off, you know, the tops of really high mountains. They will go up there and take these things down. And the only ones then really that tend to be lost are the ones that have gone into like a bog, as we did with the Eagle, the American RAF Eagle Squadron Spitfire that we did way back in 2011. It buried itself 40 foot down.
Wow.
And effectively the Irish Army came out, stood there digging for 2 days and thought, oh, the heck with this.
Yeah.
We're not getting anywhere near this.
Yeah.
And off they went. So you then have to try and find where that spot is. So it's only those ones that are, you know, uniquely buried in soft ground conditions that are still well preserved and still there. Others pretty much are well picked over, or only it's the really heaviest parts that are left up in the most remotest places that nobody really ever goes that are left. ¶¶
The Partnership Edge is the new podcast from XTP Media. It is focused on how trust turns ordinary partnering contracts into successful long-term alliances. Each episode features a senior leader on how behaviours within the partnership can reduce risk, increase innovation, and outperform the shared alliance objectives. Search for The Partnership Edge on your preferred podcast platform to hear more on building trusted partnerships.
G'day, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran from Plain Crazy Down Under.
And you're listening to Extended.
So we talked about the site and finding it, and of course, the digging. What happens when you get to the elements, the pieces? How then do they come out? How do you then treat them? And what's that whole process like when you actually hit the place where the resting place of that aircraft?
We would go there and we work with a very small team. Like, it's all voluntary. So we will have our archaeological team. Sometimes we'll have some pupils working with us, and about four or five like-minded individuals who think this is a sound pastime for a weekend. And we will do like a set of points that we want to do. Does the forensic evidence that we find show that the aircraft struck the ground the same way as all the eyewitnesses said? You know, is it absolutely vertical? Did it go in and then, you know, spin across the field? Because if they sort of tend to crash and slide across the field, all the wreckage can be gathered up.
Yeah.
And it's away, and there'll be nothing left. And it's, when you talk to, you know, a certain generation in Northern Ireland, you know, every field has a Spitfire in it. Even though you're trying to tell this, it's actually not. This is a different aircraft. Oh, it's almost a Spitfire.
Yeah.
So we will do that. So we'll scrape the digger, will take the soil off, the sods off, because again, you're respectful that this is a farmer's field. Yeah. And you don't want it, you know, looking like a bomb site.
How does the landowner get involved? You know, the farmer or whatever, do they have a voice? Do they have an opinion?
Yeah.
Is there an approval process?
Yes, the MOD in your Protection of Mildly Remains Act license, you have to get a signed form from the landowner to say that they are content for you to be on their land. So if the farmer meets you at his gate with a pitchfork, you ain't getting on the land.
Yeah.
You're not getting a license. It's that. And I think in all the years, apart from one slightly grumpy person, we have always been absolutely encouraged. Yes, where do you want me to sign?
Yeah.
This is great. You know, So they're all very happy. You know, because the story's been passed down, you know, through the family about, do you remember the day the plane crashed? It's a big excitement. And to see actually what's left is very good. So we have to, we scrape the sods off, and then we will put a drone up, and you will be looking for burn marks in the brown soil to see, like, was there evidence of an explosion? Is that what the eyewitnesses said? We will look for that debris pattern, and aluminium decomposes and it sort of goes like washing powder, like blue DAS, we would call it. It just crumbles away into these blue crystals. So you start following that down as you scrape, you know, 3 or 4 inches off at a time. So that's when you're telling the pupils, you know, and everyone else, you know, keep your eyes skinned. And the next thing that we tell them is to look with your nose. It's very important that you look with your nose when you're digging, because once you start getting into the oil smell or the aviation fuel smell, which is very characteristic, then you know that you're coming down onto those larger parts that would have it. And then you're waiting for that, you know, scrunch sound when the digger gently starts to hit more compacted metal. And then you have to go, right, take a step back. For example, a Spitfire is about 30 foot long and a 34 foot wingspan. But if you can imagine the Spitfire, when it hits the ground, it'll compact into a cube about 5 or 6 foot. So you then have to take a step back and excavate around the sides and leave that crumpled bit in the middle, and then work out what's the best way of lifting that. And we will have on hand all our storage boxes. We will have wet newspaper if there's any fabric, sort of like harnesses, flying helmets, anything like that, paperwork, that all goes into bags and that'll all go off to get preserved. We will also have various protocols in place for any small arms munition, 303, and there'll be a whole process then to ring either the police or the bomb squad at the end of the day to say there's something here that you need to get rid of. And we do that. And then so we will get most of the wreckage out of the way, and if the engine is in one piece and it has gone down deeper, then you dig down following that stain in the ground until you get the engine. And as a license holder, you are legally obliged to bring everything, well, certainly in Northern Ireland, to preserve everything to a museum standard. So then that's when your house smells of fuel, your wife loses her toothbrushes, there's no earbuds in the house because they're all downstairs at the back sink.
So where does it go? I mean, apart from your garage, and I am sure you pretty much do that for almost everything that you cover, but do museums get involved and support you with that? Yep. Sort of thing?
They do. We will not lift an aircraft unless it's going to a home at
right,
the end of
okay,
it.
Yeah.
And that's it. There may be, one that we've done where, if you can imagine a cat litter tray, all that we have found could go into a cat litter tray. For example, the one that we did in Ballykelly, because you're doing an excavation of an excavation. They removed the plane in 42, but we went back specifically, for several reasons, with the consent of the MOD, just to check that the site was clear of all the remains of the aircraft and or the crew. And also then because there was no marker to tell the story of what happened to those three men.
Yeah.
Everyone referred to the field to the left of it. Oh, that's the crash field. These guys were sort of lost for 80 years in a field being used for sheep grazing. And right. The church that was the landowner went, that's dreadful. No, come on, let's do something. And we raised money, about £5,000, and we put in the most beautiful wee memorial. And so you do all that, you're responsible. So some digs, yes, you only have a few little trinkets, but they're really important. Others, you end up like Donegal, where we effectively have a Spitfire sitting in your garage, yeah, everything apart from the wings. That all has to be inventoried, numbered, identified, all cleaned, preserved. So you're going, what's decomposing first? What do I nearly need to get to and preserve and clean? So anything with like writing on a paintwork, anything, yeah, like that. And then you work your way back through everything else. And then you have to present under the MOD law a list. So you present a list of everything that I found, all labelled. Here's all the descriptions. And then they decide either to relinquish ownership back. But we've always done an agreement that not coming to me, it's going to this museum,
right,
at the
okay
end of the day.
Yeah.
So that's where it goes. They get everything, lock, stock and two smoking barrels.
Okay, so we've talked about some of the examples. I want to come back to the Donegal Spitfire in a moment, but the Ballykelly, was that the Beaufort? Was that the Coastal Command,
yep,
Beaufort?
Yep.
Now, you mentioned, unfortunately, the crew lost their lives with that. Tell us about... Mm-hmm. The sensitivity of a site like that, and how you work with the families to sensitively handle something like that, because we're talking about airplanes and bits of metal, but I think what I'm starting to picture is that before you do, before you get to site, you're investigating the stories, the evidence, what's in the domain, to understand what's happened before you even scrape the ground. But then, of course, you've also mentioned, and it's come up quite a few times, families and communities. So you've got that very emotive balance to make as well with the work you do. How do you manage that?
You have to be acutely sensitive to any of the families we have found, because many of them know that their loved one died in Northern Ireland, but don't know where or the circumstances. And we had just finished up a dig doing a P-38 Lightning in Monaghan, which completed sort of all the trilogy of digging all the aircraft that ever crashed in Monaghan for a very successful museum exhibition. And I got a phone call to my desk, an elderly chap from England down near the south coast. And he just said, you don't know me, but my name's Ron. And he says, my father was Flight Sergeant Stanley Chadwick, who lost his life in a coastal command, Beaufort. And we believe that he and this Richard Holdsworth and Flight Lieutenant Duncan Livingstone, who also lost their lives in it, lost their lives needlessly. And he said, we've seen you walking up and down, doing all your surveying stuff on some other TV programs. Could you ever go and find where this actually happened so that we could have a photograph of the site? And this was just about when COVID was kicking off. And I said,
yeah, of course.
And I had to say to him, look, you know, anything that has, you know, human remains, the remains of the crew, you know, it'll get no further than I can show you where the site is. And that's it. But he says, we as a family, so the crew family, so there's Stanley was the son of the navigator. We also then had Di, who was the daughter of Richard Holdsworth. And then we also had the nephew of Duncan Livingstone, who was the pilot. And they, for several years, had been chatting as a team, a Beaufort Ballykelly team,
yeah,
on this. And then Ron just said, look, could you go and look? So we spent a year looking in the crash field, only to find out that the crash field wasn't the crash field, it was the field next door. And then when we say, one of the good things of your father being a minister means then that because it was the front garden of the Church of Ireland rectory, I had like a foot in the door to say to the rector, you know, there's three guys died here, and there's no memorial to them. We don't know what, if anything, is left at the site. But again, I said, look, we will not get any permission to dig this. And we spoke to the MOD, and I must admit they were very sensitive to the crew's wishes. And they had to reply back on the usual line, no, there may be human remains at the site, so you can't get permission to dig.
Yeah.
And the family of the crew said, well, that's possibly the worst thing that you could have said to us, because do you believe that there is human remains at the site? And they could see where this was going. And I said, like, I don't want to fall out with the MOD because I need them to get my licenses for all the other digs. But it's a good point that they raise. And then the church wrote a really lovely letter that just said, look, you know, as a church, as a parish, to think that we have sheep walking up and down this unmarked field where these three guys might be, and there might be any trace of them left, we would really urge you to reconsider. And I'd put a letter in to say, look, given the sort of the close circumstances that we have here of working with the police on many digs, the police forensic people have said that they will come out and assist and work with us all, and the bomb squad guys will do it. And given some unique other wee bits of legislation that we brought into play, the MOD very kindly and bravely issued a license to myself as a non-archaeologist in the middle of COVID to forensically make sure that that site was clear and to give essentially that peace of mind to the families in England.
Yeah.
And we did that, and we had some pupils working with us as well, like A-level pupils of age, and they forensically worked across that site. Hand on heart, we found nothing, but we could see the evidence of how the plane had crashed.
Yeah.
And we were able to tell them that at the time the crash crew had meticulously cleared that site, so your loved ones were all taken away on the day of the crash. There is nothing here.
Yeah.
Hold nothing back. And we were able then to get some parts of the aircraft that had crashed and burnt, and the aluminium had melted down into these lovely shapes, and we got them all made up into lovely little ornaments on a stone plinth. And then we organised a service where we brought all the families together, and what we didn't tell them was that there was a Battle of Britain Spitfire was going, and it flew the same route that their Beaufort had flown all those years before, did a couple of rolls, not a dry eye in the house. But that's how we do it properly. We wrapped the whole thing up, that the family had been there, they're able to lay wreaths, see where their loved ones had died. They had a bit of it, and then they met all the pupils, and the pupils had divided themselves into Team Chadwick, Holdsworth and Livingstone, and they kept in contact, you know, with them on the day by ringing. We've just found an engine pit. We've just found another engine pit.
Yeah.
We've got these wee bits and all. So, yeah, that's the amount of effort
that
goes in. But you're acutely aware of, I have to respect the memory of these guys and their living relatives. And the plane sort of comes a wee bit down underneath that.
Well, given what I've just finished from a Coastal Mark Command perspective, I'm certainly very grateful for the work you've done on that. So thank you very much. Let's come back to talk about the Donegal Spitfire. That's the one that gets talked about, I suppose, the most. And I wasn't aware, I am now, that you wrote a book. Tell us about the Donegal Spitfire.
Oh, dear goodness. I've ruined aviation archaeology by possibly doing the best one that you can ever do, you know, really at the start under your own steam. And then every other dig since then, people go, well, it'd be like Donegal. And you're going, no. You know, so that was 2011, the BBC in Northern Ireland were doing a series called Dig World War II, and it was about Northern Ireland's pivotal role during World War II. You know, which services were here, what were they doing, training, flying, you know, getting ready for their army or their navy, and all the things that Northern Ireland provided, and what tangibly was left that we could show them. So we weren't going to do this with like three bearded guys in tweed suits smoking pipes, you know, waffling on about anything. We were actually going to go out and show you, here's what's left of these coastal command airfields. Here's the bomber command, the fighter airfields. And at each episode, the long-suffering producer wanted an aviation dig. And myself and my young daughter went out and found an American Eagle Squadron pilot aircraft that crashed. And because Ireland was neutral during the war, there are no records in the RAF, squadron books at Eglinton. It basically said pilot took off, crashed Donegal. Now, Donegal's a big place to do ground penetrating radar. So you have to then go into the Irish records, and all they said was crash near the village of Glenealy. And you need to go then knocking on all the doors. And we eventually found out through the most tremendous twists of turns of fate, and also chocolate buttons. I must stress to all your listeners that aviation archaeology does not happen without chocolate buttons. And just in case you think I'm winding you up, I'll show you this picture, which doesn't really work well on radio. But that is the actual packet of chocolate buttons on my young daughter on Dig Day.
Lovely picture.
Because she asked for those chocolate buttons, we met everyone in a shop who could then piece by piece take us to the spot where the plane crashed. It was buried 40 foot down. It was the first licensed dig of an aircraft in Ireland, north or south. So the Irish authorities really believed that archaeology was like proper archaeology. You know, you upstarts doing 80-year-old stuff. Nah. And we had to fight and fight and fight. And then we got it done when we started dealing with the head Irish antiquarian, who's absolutely brilliant, and really said, like, you know, as long as you don't mess things up, I'm prepared to give you this chance. And our relationship with him has been brilliant ever since. And we excavated possibly the best preserved Spitfire found in Europe. It was 40 foot down in a hole in a bog, about a mile from the nearest road. The preservation was that good that the machine guns that we lifted, we got those to fire using the Irish Army.
Wow.
We restored them.
Wow.
The pilot's helmet was still there, and then we traced the pilot's family with using the FBI, and we brought Betty and Barbara over. My father did a wee service on the Moor 70 years to the very minute that Bud Wolf had crashed. Again, that was not a great day for trying to stay dry-eyed. And it just set such a high bar, but it really got people interested in, you know, aviation archaeology and how do you do this, and you could explain then the licensing. But it's the one that everyone, you know, even what are we now, 15 years later, when you're doing talks to groups, oh, tell us a story about the Donegal Spitfire. We do other digs. Oh, no, Donegal. You know?
And are any of those pictures behind you, around you, of the Donegal Spitfire?
Yes, I mean, one of the other good things about digging up a Spitfire that's been donated by a Canadian billionaire, there's a big picture here. It was donated by Garfield Weston. So he, himself and Lord Beaverbrook started the, you know, the whole Wings and Gift of Giving Spitfires, which then led to all the newspaper appeals, and the Belfast Telegraph appeal spawned, I think, 17 Spitfires. So he presented a cheque that was about £100,000, it's rumoured. And our Spitfire P8074 was the very first one that he ever donated. And when we rang him from the dig site to say that we had actually found the bit, so Garfield Weston, who donated the graph, he's passed away, but his son Galen was still alive. And I remember ringing him on the day to say that we'd found the bit that had Garfield Weston written down the side of it.
And there were
tears. And we spent a week with them in Canada. The family came over and we presented him with that piece. And it was very emotional. Again, he said he was the youngest of the children, and whereas the rest of the family were talking about what their dad was doing during the war, he was doing so much secret work for Churchill and donating money for tanks and feeding everybody in the underground during the Blitz. And he said he was, you know, shuffling around in his bum and his nappies, and he couldn't talk to the family. So to hold these tangible pieces now was great for
him. Very special. And is the book still available?
Book's still available.
Where can we find it?
Probably the best place is to contact myself on Facebook, Johnny McNee, Aviation Archaeology, and my wonderful son who looks after that. So if anybody's interested in getting the book, The Story of the Donegal Spitfire, it's £12 plus postage, and I have a few copies left.
Good.
But it's a 120 pages, and there's lots of photographs in the middle. And again, it starts with chocolate buttons.
Right. I'm top of that list. So I want to come back and talk a little bit about a mutual friend we've got. But first, I just wanted to congratulate you. I know it's 6 months after we originally connected on the award of the British Empire Medal. Congratulations on that, and it's very, very well deserved for all the work that you've done. But I suppose what I want to try and find out from you is how does that recognition help the work that you do and the group of people that you work with? You know, because although you've invested so much time and energy, you've explained quite a few times there's wider groups, there's disparate groups, there's different stakeholders. How does that recognition put a bit of a spotlight on the work that you do? And how can we really, I suppose, expose that a bit more? Because this work's not being well highlighted enough, is it, really?
No, it is seem as niche, but I appreciate that, because I think given, you know, the sensitivities that it could be, you know, nefarious sorts could get in, we do it quietly, and we don't, when we're promoting it, we always do it afterwards. We don't tell people we're going out to this field to dig something up, because you'll have every Tom, Dick and Harry out with a metal detector trying to ruin it. And there's also the health and safety stuff, but... Yes. The letter arrives saying that the king's going to give you a medal, and you think, no, this is a scam. and then when it does sink in, and I'll be honest, I just do this, and the thought of we've had our fun at Hillsborough and we had our fun at Buckingham Palace, and you still think there's obviously been a mistake, and this is going to get taken off at some point. But as you say, you think, am I worthy to get it? And it's only when you stop and think back about how much you've done, and the tears with families, and you've helped, you know, unite people, and or you've spent a wet weekend taking photographs for somebody to send to Australia to say this is where your dad served.
Yeah.
And then you think, actually, we've done a lot. And then there's the flip side. And that's the bit that sometimes I have trouble with, is that you get the medal. I get this medal. But I'm sitting there going, I couldn't do this without, you know, Alistair and the surveying and my son who does all this and all the other people that help. You know, we all bring our own. I bring, you know, stubborn enthusiasm to it. Alistair brings his dark art of surveying. And we need all of that to present a picture then to the archaeologist to say that there is something here, and we can do it. So Yes, there's a bit of it. It sits uneven, a bit awkward on my shoulder still. But everyone is all very happy and very chuffed, and we're all still talking. And the medal stays, and the medal stays in my house.
Yeah,
but it's good that you can use it. I mean, the Lord Lieutenant for the county who presented my medal at Hillsborough. You know, she then, Lord Lieutenant Alison Miller, is asking, you know, well, how many people died? Here's a couple of other projects that I've been made aware of. Can you help with that? So it does add, you know, a wee bit of gravitas and a wee bit of seriousness, you know, to what you're doing. And it takes it above that sort of, like, you know, perception initially by some archaeologists that this might be like a Mickey Mouse type, you know, type of archaeology.
Yeah.
It is proper and it's done properly, and we do it to all the codes and conducts and protocols, and it brings a lot of satisfaction to people, and it's a great way of getting particularly young people interested in history, and then they might diversify and go off and look at traditional archaeology and things like that. So it does just add a wee bit when you're ringing somebody up, and not that we're ringing up going, hello, this is Johnny BEM here, can I have, you know, something. I'm not doing that, but
I understand.
It shows you that your seriousness, and that seriousness has been recognised. So, it opens doors a wee bit wider.
Okay. Now, before I let you go, got to talk about a friend, a mutual friend and acquaintance, and a mutual aircraft and a acquaintance. I mentioned that my father flew in Northern Ireland a few times. Maydown came up, and I've probably got to do a bit more work on that, because his crew formed and unformed and formed again, and I think they separated in Northern Ireland, so I'm not quite sure about that bit. So I need to go back and do that, but I'm actually going to see DP-872, the Barracuda that's being built at the Fleet Air Arm Museum, in a week's time. I go there maybe every year or two to see the progress they're making. So it's close to my heart because one doesn't exist anymore. And Dave Morris in particular has been a fabulous support, certainly the research I had to do. But you were very, very involved in that aircraft. Tell us a little bit about that and how that came about.
Yes, that's an apocryphal story around the city of Derry, where I live. Everyone remembers the Enoch Lock Barracuda that crashed in 1944, in August 1944, taking the lives of the three crew, sadly, that were in it, that were over here visiting and then flying back to East Haven in Scotland. And first of all, when you start investigating it, you find out that it actually didn't crash in Enoch Lock. It crashed in a bog beside it. And then when we put an appeal out, and we said, look, we're going to hold an event in a local church. And Dave and the rest of the team came over from the Fleet Air Arm. And we said, look, if you saw this, if your granny was there taking photographs on the day that it went in, or when it subsequently it was removed in 71, let us know what you have. If you have any photographs, anything. And we did that, and the response was tremendous. John, people remember how the aircraft crashed, and there was a lot of bad feeling at the time in the surrounding community at the sort of half-hearted attempt to retrieve the aircraft, and how the naval officers appeared more interested in keeping their feet clean and getting something out of the back of the aircraft. And there wasn't so much emphasis on, sorry, what about the three poor souls that are in this? And the local community were, like, you know, were standing waist deep on top of the aircraft as it sunk, trying to smash the perspex to reach in. And the Navy were, you know, drawing pistols and saying, you know, get back, you lot. And they got stuff and off they went. And so there was that bad taste in the community about, you know, the spoils of war. This is dreadful. You know, how these young men are just killed and left. Yeah. And then in 71, the aircraft was lifted. And again, then it was because I think the RAF or the Navy were trying to get examples of the various aircraft that had, you know, flown during the war. And it was likely that Barracuda DP-872 would provide the most substantive possible project for remains. And I traced some of the guys that were involved in the Navy rescue team. There's only two alive now. And we had some great conversations about how that came about. another family friend, we found out, was actually the police, the RUC, the police superintendent at the time in charge of all the security. And he had a whole big file on it. And he managed to give me large chunks of that to show how they worked on the site. And again, you know, you find out all the stories that the crew or the people working on it, they didn't know that there was bodies in the aircraft until the aircraft was lifted. It had been kept quiet. And so that all came out and was taken away to Sydenham and then to be cleaned. And then it made its way around various places until it has fallen into the wonderful hands of Dave and Will and the rest of the guys that are restoring it at Yeovilton. And we, at the request of Dave, the wingtips are missing and the tail's missing. And the story is that they were cut off at the time to allow the plane to sink into the bog. So out of sight, out of mind, can you all just forget about the crew? They're obviously dead. And that plane's out of the way and we don't have anything to visibly worry about. And we spent a year and a bit, mostly in the winter when the pond is cleanest and the vegetation's at its lowest. We haven't got to the bottom of the bog yet. We cannot get a pole deep enough down. We're still not hitting anything. Yeah. But we were wading through this with our radar and inventing new ways of putting the radar into like a child's inflatable paddling pool and then pulling it over the bog. And we were able to see the imprint that the aircraft had pushed in. We then, under license again, managed to find out under certain weather conditions that the bog water was pushing artifacts up and down through the column of mud, and we managed to get two bits left and right, which would have corresponded with people axing off the wingtips and the tail plane. So we were able to go back to Will and Dave and say, don't spend your money coming here, draining this bog, putting in a coffer dam, because you ain't going to find anything. You need to put your money somewhere else. So then they went off to Norway and recovered a few other bits and to pull some bits out of the Solent. And we were there at the start of the year, doing a wee bit of work just to say that we had gone back and I removed a rivet from one of from one of the wing sections. So I'm now a Barracuda Restorer third class.
Excellent.
According to Dave.
Excellent. Their
preservation work is brilliant.
Yeah.
He's a tremendous character. I have a lot of time for Dave.
So much knowledge.
Oh, yeah.
Looking forward to crossing his path. Johnny, as we sort of start to wrap up, we mentioned the Fleet Air Arm there, but obviously the RAF were in strong presence at the time too. Is there any particular sites or projects in and around the region that you still want to undertake, you've got your eye on, or you wonder about, or there's a mystery about that you think, I wish we could do that?
There's a little sort of like black book of wild goose chases that I would like to work through. But the thing that scares me is a lot of these goose chases, we actually find geese. and it's just trying to organise all the time. The RAF, and I mean, the support that we get from the good folk up at Aldergrove, they are brilliant. They are very supportive on all our projects, whether they are RAF, Navy, or a project that we're about to start in a couple of weeks, you know, even international. They are a tremendous help, and they are actively investigating, like a history trail where people will be able, like, you know, perhaps an online thing to start off with, to take them around all the airfields and say, like, this side was defending Belfast, and then as you came along the north coast, this was, you know, helping out with the convoys, and then you've all the Battle of the Atlantic was on this side, and here's what you can see, and all that. So there's a lot of support. There is one story of a missing aircraft that we're looking for that we will go, because there's a few wee things pointing that have surfaced, not physically, but just enough to make us think, with the support of the RAF, and they said they might be able to helicopter us up to this particular location, that we could do some sonar work to rule in or rule out a local myth. But at the minute, no, we have a project starting shortly, which is going to take up a a lot of time. Might be on a par with Donegal, but for completely different reasons.
Yeah. How do you balance this with your day job? You've got a pretty intense day job as well. How do you get that balance right? I mean, I know I caught you on a bad day, arriving a few minutes before I hit the record button. You've certainly got a lot on your plate.
I like to be busy. Sometimes you need something to divert your interest, but at the same time you need to recognize that you need to look after, you know, the family and the wife and these, and tell you when
the balance is
you gotta be you didn't get a knighthood, so come like wind your neck in, as they say around here, and do some house things. But it's good. And with as a marine planner, which is what my day job is with the Department of Agriculture and Environment and Rural Affairs, sometimes I am called out by the archaeologists as part of their scanning around the intertidal area to say, what's that pile of metal? And the next minute I could find myself, you know, walking out across Loch Foyle to identify a little dragonfly helicopter.
Yeah.
And you're thinking, this is great. I'm getting paid for this today. This is a work thing. So it's separate, but there's a nice wee overlap.
Yeah.
Sometimes, but they're very supportive of it, because they recognize that everybody needs their own wee strange pastime to unwind sometimes from the day job.
Well, there's an av geek in us all. Johnny, where, before we leave you, is the best place to find out and track what's going on, the Facebook page, or are there other places we can find you online?
No, the best place would be Facebook. My son Dylan looks after all of that. So for various reasons, we've been sort of hinting that we have a big project coming up. We may not be able to show a lot of photographs at the time, but we'll try and show a few. So Johnny McNee Aviation Archaeology on Facebook. You will find everything that we've done in the past and some of the other mad adventures that we have undertaken. And you'll see lots of photographs of us, you know, either doing digs, some of the characters that I've talked about. We recently retrieved a very rare seafire propeller from the River Fawn near the city. And on that day, we were accompanied by a goat, and we put that story up. And we had about 200-300 likes very quickly. So, nobody's interested in aviation archaeology, but put a picture of a goat in. everybody thought that was wonderful.
That's social media for you. Listen,
yes,
Johnny,
yeah.
What a fascinating activity you undertake. It's really been interesting learning a bit more about the work you do. It's really, really important work, and although we have a laugh and a smile about the goat, it's quite important historically as well that this work continues. So thanks so much for sharing that with us, for taking time out tonight.
Not a problem. Like I say, there is a very serious side, but you do need sometimes to laugh, and we've had a few good belly laughs over the many years we've been doing this.
Thanks very much, Johnny.
Thank you.
We'd like to thank White Hearts for our music, and I would like to personally thank those of you who have stuck with us over the past few months while we produced our book, Constant Endeavour, RAF Coastal Command. You can find the audiobook on all major audiobook platforms and the ebook through Amazon. There'll be links in the show notes. We appreciate the demands on everyone, but if you could support us with buying a copy of either the e-book or the audiobook, every penny goes to Help for Heroes. You can find me at Nascot Hornet on social media, and of course, through the multiple XTP media platforms. If you're interested, my other podcast, The Partnership Edge, talks to senior leaders about the importance of trust in strategic alliances. It's on all the major podcast players. You can find Tim, Ellie and Gareth on both their personal and, of course, through the extended social feeds. And that's it. With the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. And remember, stay tuned to this frequency. It is Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. programmes produced with a Creative Commons licence.
Please leave us a review wherever you play your podcast. It genuinely helps grow our programme and broaden its reach. You can also review the programme and leave us feedback on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to email us, our email address is getinvolved@aviationextended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of Extended.
Extended.
This is XTP Media.